You've probably heard of Kicks for Cancer, and you've probably seen the pink and teal t-shirt lawn signs around town, but how much do you really know about KFC? This year marks the 14th annual Kicks for Cancer, and number 14 is completely different from the first 13 thanks to COVID. Had things been normal this year, the last Saturday in September would have been a full day of high school soccer and field hockey. Fantastic live event, but almost every part of Kicks this year has to be virtual. And the next hour on WIQH is part of this year's alternate KFC. WIQH sports co-director Jack Henry Eaton leads off, talking with CCHS boys soccer head coach Ray Pavlik and assistant coach Steve Wells. The death of Coach Wells' mom from cancer prompted the first Kicks for Cancer, and Coach Pavlik organized that first event. The second part of our program today features Concord-Carlisle High School teacher Nora Murphy and CCHS 2016 graduate Natalie Waldron. Dr. Murphy was diagnosed with cancer in 2016, while Natalie was one of her students. The cancer obviously had a life-changing effect on Murphy, but it also impacted Waldron in a powerful way. So here's Jack Henry with Mr. Pavlik and Mr. Wells to start us off.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to WIQH. My name is Jack Henry Eaton, and I will be interviewing Mr. Wells and Mr. Pavlik today about the 13th annual Kicks for Cancer event. Thank you both for being here.
Welcome, JH.
Glad we could do this. I guess let's get right into it. And no better place to start than at the beginning. So, Mr. Wells, do you think you could tell us a little bit about how this event started and what it means to you?
Sure. The event started after my mother, Lois, passed away from ovarian cancer in 2007. This was March of 2007 when she passed away. After being diagnosed less than a year prior with stage 4 ovarian cancer. Obviously this was a tough time in my life when my mom passed away. I was very close with her. Coach Pavlik, he wanted to rally the soccer team around me and help me through this difficult time. And so it was actually his idea at first the idea was to do like a fundraising walk to raise money for Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where my mom received her treatments. Unfortunately, that didn't work out due to, restrictions on fundraising minimums for each player. So Coach Pavlik came up with the genius idea of doing like a benefit game, a tribute game. And so that's where the idea came from. That fall, we played against Boston Latin. Every player was wearing a pink long sleeve shirt that had Wells on the back with their number. And, it was a great night, which I can tell you more about. But it obviously means a lot. And it really helped me through a difficult time in my life, gave me something positive, like a silver lining to look at, and still something that my family has always appreciated, and we always kind of rally around that. A lot of my family members attend the event every year. My mother's sister, who lives in upstate New York, drives 6 hours every year just to come to the event. So it's really been amazing for my family and me, and then at this point now the community as a whole, I think. So it's extremely significant for me, and it was really just Coach Pavlik's kind heart and kind of wanting to help a friend who was going through a tough time that led to it all.
Yeah, well, that's awesome, and you kind of touched upon how it's grown into the community. So we'll shift it over to you, Mr. Pavlik. When you started and when you had this idea, what were you kind of hoping for out of the first Kicks for Cancer?
You know, I always tell people that this is a project, I think, that was born out of love. And it was born out of love for Coach Wells. You know, the team cared about him a lot. And, you know, they were at his memorial service for his mom. They were at the funeral service and wanted to come up with a way to surprise and support and, you know, let him know that we were there for him and also do something for his family. And I think there's just, you know, there was just because of that, that's where it began. Like, you know, that I love, I think that's really important. One of the reasons why it's just been successful and it's succeeded. Our mission really for the first time was just to be seen. And it, you know, we surprised him by putting Wells on the back of the shirt and the kids felt proud, you know, to support him. And we ended up raising, you know, several thousand dollars and it was great. And we said, you know what, let's do this again. With no expectation that it would grow. And each year we sort of added a little bit. And I think, you know, one of the biggest transitions for us is when we started putting people's names on the back. You know, after we did Wells the first year, you know, at some point we said, you know, let's expand this a little bit and let's allow the individual players to put the names of somebody who's special on their back and to them and has battled cancer, is battling somebody they want to represent. And that, I think, has really made this so personal for everybody involved. And it's helped the spread. I still, you know, when we look back at what it is now and, you know, so many teams, it was never the we didn't have a vision like this, you know, originally. It was really just about 1 year. And but it was just such a positive day. And the kids and the players felt good about it. And Coach Wells felt good about it. And his family came down and we had the choir from his mom's church sing the national anthem. And, you know, that day really was about representing or remembering Lois and in a different way. So that, you know, and then we just was such a positive day. We're like, you know, we got to keep doing, we got to keep going. This could turn into something.
Yeah. Well, you think it's safe to say that it exceeded all expectations if there was no set plan?
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's with everything that we're doing and, you know, adding the Mighty Moose and there's nothing better for me. I walk around or drive around town, you know, and you see kids everywhere just wearing bright pink shirts. You know, they're 6 years old. There's parents. I mean, it's just something that has become part of the community. And really it's to me, one of the biggest community events, if not the biggest community event we have.
Well, absolutely. So you talked about raising the money and while it's not all about the money, it's certainly one of the greatest things that we can do for Dana-Farber Women's Cancer Research. The total now after 13 years is over 490,000, which, I mean, stop right there. That's an amazing tally and something we can all be proud of. Do you guys know and could share this information with the listeners of this, kind of what that money goes to and maybe some of the things that people could expect if they were to donate?
So originally we made this to women's cancers at Dana-Farber. And for years, it just sort of was earmarked. At some point, you know, the conversation came, well, where does that money go to? And it turns out, I think a large percentage of women's cancer research money goes towards breast cancer. And a smaller amount goes towards ovarian cancer. And as we talked about that, it seemed like we wanted to start to earmark it specifically towards ovarian cancer and try to focus it a little bit more on the research side. You know, we've had a teacher who's diagnosed. We had a community member whose husband played in the program and who passed away. And so the focus has really turned now to supporting research. Unfortunately, with ovarian cancer, you know, because of the fact that there's not a really good detection system, most of the, you know, the survival rate of it, unless you happen upon it, is not good. and it's about trying to extend life, but not save life. In most cases, you know, once you talk about somebody getting diagnosed with third and fourth, there's just, you know, you hope, but eventually, too often, you know, it ends in someone losing a life. And so the focus here is now, how do we detect this, and how do we figure out a way to find this in women early so that it is treatable, so that we don't have to worry about, you know, a treatment as much as we're, you know, we get it so soon. So the money's going towards early detection, and then also trying to support trials for drugs. You know, we've partnered, and the Mighty Moves came out of this. You know, Jenna Swaim and I had spoken. She had asked to somehow get involved in Kicks for Cancer, and had said, you know, what if we did a race, and somehow, and that was born out of Kicks for Cancer, and has now made a huge impact into the total money that we've brought in. And we've, you know, partnered with Dr. Elias, as well as doing some groundbreaking research right now. And, you know, when you donate now, I think it's, instead of it going just to sort of this general fund of women's cancers, you can know now that it's going to this particular research project. And the fact that you donate is going to help these, you know, treatments and drugs potentially get through trial twice as fast as they normally did. And that means at some point, you know, this you're talking about, if it gets, you know, through trials a year ahead of time, that's a year earlier that it's going to start helping people. You're talking about people will live, right? You're literally saving someone's life here. And I think for people, as they, you know, they hear that story, it there's a deeper connection to what this is doing and what their participation in the event does.
Well, absolutely. And unfortunately, Ms. Swaim passing away kind of brought on the Mighty Moose in her honor. What do you think an event like this, you said too that it's easily one of the biggest events our community has. What do you think it does for everyone in the community to see the pink jerseys everywhere, to have so many fans at the game, to see all the people come and show out? Because obviously cancer is something that affects all of us. What do you guys think it means to our community as a whole, and like what kind of opportunity does it present for us to all kind of reflect on the loved ones that are fighting or that have lost the fight?
Well, I think, you know, the community aspect is really amazing. Even just here at CCHS, you know, traditionally the week leading up to the event, you know, especially the day before, you'll see teachers and students in the halls. Everyone's wearing their pink and now teal shirts. You know, we have the pink dance the night before here at CCHS, where students will come and all the ticket money from that is donated. So now it's really, you know, like Mr. Pavlik said, it's all around town, and you know, you can barely drive through town without seeing a pink or a teal shirt somewhere. You know, my daughter, whenever hers is clean, she always wears it first thing. That's her go-to shirt. So you know, it's also spreading to other towns too. You know, I live in Sudbury now, and I bumped into a former LS player in my neighborhood, and he was just talking about what it meant to him to play in Kicks for Cancer. And he said it was his, you know, despite winning state championships, he said playing in Kicks for Cancer was, you know, the thing he remembered the most about playing at LS. So to me, that's unbelievable that it's now spreading to other towns and other communities and growing bigger.
Absolutely. I think unfortunately with everything that's going on with COVID, there won't be the large community presence at the games. However, there will still be a game played this year. Do you think that, and you said too, that the players, you know, obviously feel so strongly about this event. Could you guys inform everyone and kind of tell everyone what's going to be going on this year to kind of keep up with the hype around the event and kind of keep the support going for those who need it?
I'll start and Steve, you can jump in here. So again, the game has been moved for us to the 17th. You know, it won't be a Sea of Pink up on the hill this year. It's just, you know, it's not in the cards. I think, you know, the players will still wear jerseys and still hold people close to their hearts as they play. I hope that kids will still come to school wearing pink. And, you know, still remember and take an opportunity to do whatever we can to support this research. You know, there's a lot of other initiatives. You can purchase lawn signs that are going around town, which is great. You're starting to see pink and teal lawn signs all over the place, which is amazing. And other towns are going to also be hosting games at their facilities as well. So, you know, it's a different year. You know, certainly it won't be quite the same if it's an experience, but I think we can still make an impact.
Yeah, and I would just add, I want to kind of thank all of the Kicks for Cancer committee members. You know, it's essentially parent volunteers, and they put in so much time and effort and energy into this every year, but especially this year, just trying to figure out how we can continue to grow it. And like the lawn signs that Coach Pavlik mentioned that came out of this committee. And they, you know, they have a weekly meeting to discuss strategies and how we can improve things. We've rolled out a new website, kicksforcancer1.org. And there's a lot of stuff on there. We're doing a lot of stuff on social media with what we're calling shirt stories, where the players are, you know, doing a little video about who's on the back of their shirt, who they're playing for, and things like that. So there's a lot of stuff going on to keep the momentum going this year, since it's going to be so different.
Yep, absolutely. So I think we'll wrap up with a little bit of, you said that we talked about in the beginning how this year, this will now be the 13th year, has done so much for everyone in the community and families and the people we've lost. What do you think we could expect from Kicks for Cancer in the coming years and in terms of growth and in terms of what's next just for the event and all the things that kind of support it and go with it?
You know, my hope is, you know, we get back to normal, first of all, next year, and just continue to figure out ways to grow this. I really think for me, the next step is sort of trying to put together a packet of, if you wanted to create a similar thing in your own community, what would you do? And how do you grow this? And so that we now just don't have it through Concord as the epicenter, but that we're sort of sharing with other people our experiences. And allowing this to sort of populate throughout the state, throughout the country. You know, we have people who would love to participate. And the reality is it doesn't mean they need to come here. The reality is they can start their own down on the South Shore in Western Mass or New York and Connecticut. And I think to me, that's sort of the next place that we can head. Millions are bringing in millions.
Well, hitting the half million mark, assuming we, you know, do that this year, will be incredible. And then, you know, I'm continually blown away by the money raised. You know, we were talking about that first year, I believe the number that we raised was $8,000. And at the time I was like, this is incredible. And now looking back, you know, every year we've continued to raise more and more money, and, you know, it really, millions does seem attainable in the near future if we continue to get the support from the community that we've been getting.
And for more information, you can always check out kicksforcancer1.org. That's the number one. There's donation information, Kicks for Cancer history information on that website, as well as more information about the ovarian cancer that we're trying to help raise money for. And of course, information about this year's 2020 virtual Kicks for Cancer and all the events that are surrounded by that. Mr. Wells, Mr. Pavlik, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm Jack Henry Eaton. I forgot to mention I'm a senior at Concord Carlisle High School. This will be, I think, my 8th year involved with Kicks for Cancer, whether I just 4th year being a part of it as an athlete and 8th year being a part of it as the younger brother of an athlete. But can only say, you know, words cannot really put into words, don't do it justice, just how meaningful this event is. If you haven't been here for the sea of pink on the hill and the emotion in the games and the national anthem and the honors before every game, it's truly a beautiful sight and something that we should all hope to be back to as early as next year. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope to see you around the community in your pink and teal. For now, that's all for us.
As I mentioned earlier, the second part of our program today features Concord Carlisle High School teacher Nora Murphy, who teaches biology at CCHS, and CCHS 2016 graduate Natalie Waldron. Now, Dr. Murphy was diagnosed with ovarian cancer in 2016, while Natalie was one of her students. The cancer obviously had a life-changing effect on Dr. Murphy. It also impacted Waldron in a powerful way, and as you'll hear in this interview, and they're really both interviewing each other, Natalie has gone on to become a cancer researcher, and there's lots of connection between Ms. Waldron and Dr. Murphy. So here's that part of our interview.
I'm Nora Murphy. I teach biology at CCHS, and I've been a teacher here since 2007.
Yeah, and then I'm Natalie Waldron. I graduated from Boston University in May, and I was Dr. Murphy's student in biology my senior year, so in 2016. And the reason we're reconnecting, or I realized that we had this sort of interesting connection, is because I'm working for Dr. Steve Skates at MGH, and he is working on something that Dr. Murphy helped to fundraise for, which is an early detection test for ovarian cancer.
And my interest that led to the fundraiser, which I worked on with Steve Wells, who's also a teacher here at CCHS and other people in Concord and surroundings, is that I developed ovarian cancer myself in February of 2016 when Natalie was my student. And I realized I had no symptoms. I didn't have a family history. So the cancer basically appeared out of nowhere, and it ended up that it was stage 4 metastatic cancer, meaning it had spread throughout my body, so it was difficult to treat. And I decided to do some fundraising for an early detection test for ovarian cancer.
Yeah, and that's something I was actually curious about. Did you just not know anything was wrong? How did they eventually find it?
You know, it's still confusing to me, because I felt like I sort of sensed something was not right in my lower abdomen. Mm-hmm. And on one particular day, I sort of felt like, do I feel something that shouldn't be there? But I asked my husband to check, and he felt nothing. And he thought I was just imagining things, which, of course, sometimes happens. And then what was strange is I ended up like I just couldn't shake it out of my head. And so I decided just to go to my doctor just to kind of have a professional look and be done with it. And she couldn't feel anything either. But she did blood tests. And when she got the results of the blood test, her office called me and they said that I needed to get an ultrasound done. To look, because something was clearly really off with my blood cells.
Wow. Wow. So you almost had like a sixth sense that something was wrong.
It kind of feels that way, which just seems strange. You know, yeah. I don't know where that came from.
Yeah, definitely. And you said it had been metastatic, and sort of the only thing that you noticed was that you just felt a little off, which is why it must be so important to get an early detection test because no one seems to notice or have any symptoms until it's too late.
Yeah, I mean, ovarian cancer is one of a number of cancers that tend to appear without a lot of symptoms, mm-hmm. Or sometimes no symptoms at all, or symptoms that could be misdiagnosed as something else.
Right, right.
And I imagine a future sometime when, you know, a routine visit to one's doctor includes a blood test for cancer, for ovarian cancer and other cancers as well.
Definitely.
And I think, you know, so that's where we're heading. And that's where, you know, Steve Wells's mom, he's also a teacher here at CC, his mom had died of ovarian cancer. And our fundraiser arose because we wanted to try to make a difference, because we realized that funding for ovarian cancer was so low, because it's not a very common cancer. It happens to be the most fatal of the women's cancers, but it's occurs at a much lower rate than breast cancer, for example. And so the amount of federal funding it gets is very low. Mm-hmm. And Steve and I decided that the most important area to address in research was early detection, because catching it early can make all the difference.
Definitely. Yeah, and something as simple as a blood test that women could just get at their yearly checkup could really get everyone who goes to the doctor for their physical.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And so you were, of course, out then the rest of the spring of 2016, but then you started teaching again right in the fall of 2016. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what was that like? Did it feel different coming back afterwards, after starting treatment?
It felt very different.
Yeah.
And before I fully answer your question, I actually want to ask you a question, mm-hmm. if you remember, from mm-hmm. spring 2016, mm-hmm. because I was sick. I actually had gotten kind of my preliminary diagnosis mm-hmm. on an evening. And for me, of course, it's like burned into my mind. So I can tell you it was a Wednesday evening. Mm-hmm. And then Thursday, I actually came to work and I taught, because I just wanted to like have something to do while my husband was working on getting me an appointment. Okay. Because my doctor said immediately I needed to see a specialist. Mm-hmm. And so I did that. And then that was the last I saw of all of you. Mm-hmm. And so I remember that I really wanted to come back and just see my students. And I remember I came for a visit before I had my surgery. So my first treatment was to have chemotherapy for 3 months. Mm-hmm. Roughly. And then I had surgery at the end of April. And I remember coming and visiting you. And I don't know if you remember that, or if you remember that I came to graduation. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to see those of you who were seniors,
yeah,
before you graduated. But I was curious, like, how did that feel as seeing me? Because I know, right, I looked so different.
Yeah, it was definitely kind of a shock, because you were... I remember my class was A block, so it was, I don't remember, like 7:30 in the morning, really early. And you were always there early, always, you know, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, like ready to go, like never missed a day. So when you weren't there, I think it was after February break, maybe, if I remember correctly, it was like close to that mm-hmm. time during the year. You didn't come in. And I remember the first day, everyone was kind of like, ooh, like, yay, we get to watch a movie. We don't have to do anything. Kind of just the general reaction when you have a substitute for a day. But then after it was the second day, everyone was pretty confused, just because you always came. And then the more the days went by, the more everyone was just pretty concerned, I think. And then I don't actually remember you coming in on Thursday, but I remember getting an email from you to all the students saying that you'd received an unexpected diagnosis. And I think you'd said it was ovarian cancer. And I was just like shocked. I immediately Googled ovarian cancer because I'd never known anyone who had had it. And it was definitely scary because I'd never really, I was lucky enough not to have any family members who had had cancer at that point. So it was sort of my first experience knowing someone who I would see like every day who had gotten a diagnosis, and it just seemed so out of the blue because you seemed so healthy. And it's weird because you were teaching us about cancer. So like knowing that you had it while you were teaching was just really weird to think about for me. And then I remember you coming at graduation and seeing you. And I just remember at that point, it was just good to see you. I don't actually remember you looking very different. I just remember being relieved that you were there and you were like well enough to come visit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's so nice. I mean, the graduation was such a special day for me because at that point it was after my surgery, and the surgery, I ended up having a complication that my doctor assured me was minor. Mm-hmm. She was not worried, but it kept me in the hospital for 13 days.
Oh, wow.
And I couldn't eat for part of that time. And so when I came out of surgery, I was just really depleted, you know, and that was kind of early May. And then I had to switch chemo treatments because the first chemo, they discovered when they removed the cancer as much as they could during the surgery, they discovered that the first chemo I was on wasn't really working well. And so my doctor had to invent a different chemo treatment, not really invent, but kind of go through the literature and try and figure out, well, what can be something we could try that might help this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd been through a lot in the previous, you know, month or 6 weeks before the graduation. And so seeing all of my students and knowing that you had achieved this goal of graduating and just people coming up to me and, you know, exchanging hugs, like that was just, it was so life-giving for me. And I really found that, yeah, that was a wonderful day just to know that you guys were there, even though I didn't have energy to go to the graduation, but to see everyone beforehand.
Yeah. And that's just what we remember, I think, is how strong you were to come while you were going through all of that, that you cared. And that's, I think, what the message we got before the diagnosis and after was just that you really care a lot about your students, and you want to do everything you can to help them succeed. It was definitely special that seeing you visit at graduation.
Well, I will say that I feel like I mean, obviously getting a terrible cancer diagnosis is not good fortune,
right.
You know, so that was not good. But I think that I have been so lucky in how much great support I've gotten from people here at CCHS and in other friends networks. And by people at CCHS, I mean students as well as faculty, because, you know, some of the students that year took time to send me an email, or students I'd taught before sent me cards.
Mm-hmm.
And to give my husband support, a friend of ours had set up a little afternoon visiting time, which she termed quiet companions. So a friend would come and sit for a couple hours. And some of those friends were people from CCHS.
Yeah.
So, for example, one of my quote unquote quiet companions was Mr. Kendall.
Oh. So, very quiet.
Yes. But it was great because, you know, different people would come different days. And I feel like just by staying connected to what was going on in the world that had been mine until I got sick.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave me, I think, the strength to go through day by day as I was going through an incredibly difficult treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of sustained me with the hope that I would be able to return.
Yeah, definitely. And do you think that what sort of motivated you to eventually enroll in the clinical trial without really knowing if it was going to work or not?
That's a great question. So to explain a little bit more just about my treatment progression. So number one, I had never heard of anyone who'd had ovarian cancer either mm-hmm. before I got ovarian cancer.
Right.
And I knew that it was a really tough cancer, but after my surgery, I learned that there are different types of ovarian cancers and that unfortunately, I had one that was one of the rarer types mm-hmm. and much more difficult to treat than some of the other ovarian cancers. Mm-hmm. And because research directed towards ovarian cancer has been less funded than other cancers, there aren't as many drugs that have been developed specifically for any of the ovarian cancers mm-hmm. as for some other more common cancers like leukemia and lung cancer and so forth, mm-hmm. breast cancer. So anyway, I discovered in, you know, sort of April, May of mm-hmm. 2016 that my prognosis was terrible, mm-hmm. that it was extremely unlikely that I would be able to live for 5 years with my cancer mm-hmm. and or even 3 years. And so truthfully, it felt like a miracle when in May of 2016, I got onto this chemotherapy treatment that that caused my tumors to respond all mm-hmm. of a sudden. And it was truly amazing. And so I stayed on that chemo. My doctor said, let's just run it until it's not helping anymore. Mm-hmm. And so what that meant was by doing periodic scans, CT scans, he could observe how the tumors were changing. And it reached a point at the end of that year where the tumors weren't shrinking anymore. Mm-hmm. And so, but I still had cancer. Mm-hmm. I'm a little wandering, but I need to backtrack and say I had one of the most excellent surgeons anyone could wish for. Mm-hmm. And a lovely, lovely person to boot. But I had so much cancer in me. Like, she took out everything big, but there were just hundreds or even thousands of tiny little tumors that were like 1 millimeter wow. or smaller. So there was no way. I mean, she could have worked for weeks trying to remove all of that. And so the goal of any cancer surgery is to try and get all the cancer. Mm-hmm. But that's the challenge with a late stage cancer is that it's had time to spread and to start to grow in lots of different places. And so mm-hmm. The goal with my treatment in 2016 was just to try to reduce the cancers even further. But my doctors knew it would be difficult to eliminate my cancer. Mm. And so at the end of 2016, since the chemo had kind of run its course, I continued on just a single medication that was supposed to just kind of prevent the cancer from regrowing. Mm-hmm. And for the scientists out there, it's an inhibitor of blood vessel formation. So in the first half of or 7 months of 2017, I was just on this medication that was mm-hmm. meant to kind of keep the cancer from starting to grow, but it failed in the middle of the summer. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, I didn't have a lot of options, to be perfectly honest. Like, I had the opportunity to join a drug trial, or I could go on to another traditional chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. And my doctors strongly encouraged me to try the immunotherapy. So immunotherapy is kind of this big umbrella term, but the type that I ended up getting on is a medication that actually improves your immune system's ability to find the cancer cells and destroy them. Yeah. And so it's just for the scientists, it's a protein that is injected, you know, it's infused into your blood and then circulates and then helps the immune system cells and the cancer interact and the immune mm-hmm. system cells wipe out the cancer. That's the goal. Mm-hmm. So I decided to give it a try because I talked to a couple doctors at MGH and then another cancer professional I know outside, a friend, who all thought I should give it a try and see how it goes. Because mm-hmm. the traditional chemo was always available to me.
Right.
But a trial is only going to have a certain number of people enrolling. And so, like, I didn't have a lot of time to decide. I kind of had, like, a week or two.
Oh, wow. That is quick.
Yeah. Wow.
And then you sort of decided to go with the trial just because you knew, did you know that the chemo maybe had less of a chance of being effective, or you knew it would always be there if the trial didn't work?
Yeah, I knew it would be there. And also, I know there aren't even a lot of chemo options for my cancer. And mm-hmm. so it seemed like it made sense to just try this other thing. Mm-hmm. And also, I will mention that it was a phase two trial, meaning in phase one trials, they're often testing for toxicity and just efficacy. Like, you don't even know if you're getting a dose that could affect your cancer. Mm-hmm. And a phase two trial, you know, they have, they already have some knowledge of the drug. And in fact, this particular drug has been used for a decade or more in some other cancers. Mm-hmm. So in terms of its safety, I felt pretty comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. I mean, it depends on my situation. I might be willing to jump into a phase one trial if that were my only option. But mm-hmm. this phase two trial with a drug that was familiar mm-hmm. from other cancers seemed like pretty safe, you know?
Right. Right. Yeah. And so that was in summer of 2017?
Yeah.
Okay. And then since then, you've been taking the same drug?
I have been.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's great. And it's working.
It is working. I mean, the thing that's confusing to people, mm-hmm. because as you know, I don't look like I have cancer, at least not the way we imagine people who have cancer are supposed to look. Like, I have all my hair. I'm not wearing a little headscarf. Mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, I don't look particularly sick. Mm-hmm. Yet this might be kind of the new face of cancer in a way, mm-hmm. you know, that I still have the cancer. But the medication is keeping the cancer at low enough levels mm-hmm. that it's not disrupting any of my body organs or systems right. in any significant way that we can measure.
Right.
So the doctors I work with kind of anticipate that this may be part of what we're going to see in the future with these immunotherapies, mm-hmm. that cancer, or at least certain types of cancers, might become more like having diabetes mm-hmm. or chronic heart disease, where mm-hmm. you are not 100% healthy, but with the appropriate medication and care, mm-hmm. Your life is not as impacted by your disease.
Right, right. And it's just sort of controlled by the medication.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Wow. And did your education and your background in biology, did that make the treatment any harder or easier, that you sort of knew more than the average person about what was happening?
You know, for me, it made it easier, mm-hmm. I think, because I felt like, well, I could ask more detailed questions
right.
and understand more about what was going on. Mm-hmm. Although I say that with a caveat, because when I first got sick, I was just so emotionally overwhelmed by the experience mm-hmm. that it really was taking all of my energy just to continue from one day to the next. And so right. you mentioned that you jumped on Google after getting my email to look up ovarian cancer. Mm-hmm. And I actually never jumped on Google.
Oh, wow.
Because I already knew generally that ovarian cancer was a terrible diagnosis. And I didn't want to go online mm-hmm. to find out just how terrible it was mm-hmm. for like at least the first year I was sick. I did start to eventually sometime in 2017, like I started to get more interested in learning about, well, cancer funding and mm-hmm. different types of ovarian cancer and so forth. But for a while, I just kind of left it to my doctors because I felt like they know how to take care of me. They've taken care of, you know, thousands of patients or hundreds of patients.
Right.
Although in truth, my cancer is pretty rare. My current oncologist has only had about 70 wow. patients with my particular type of cancer. And at this point, I'm actually the record holder. I'm the longest lived of his patients wow. who's had this cancer.
That's pretty amazing.
It is amazing. And I have to say, like, when I say that, it's, I mean, sometimes I joke with my husband, I'm like, hey, I broke another record, Jay. And he's like, what? And I'm like, just by being here.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, yeah. I mean, he's glad I'm here, obviously. Right. But I also am like, I've only lived for like 4.5 years with this cancer, right. You know, and I think of all the other women right. who just didn't have that opportunity because the drug that I'm taking didn't exist for them, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And did it sort of change your outlook on things just knowing that you are sort of breaking so many defying so many odds? And I don't know, I feel like with treatment, especially before you started the immunotherapy, it's kind of like scan to scan, knowing like you don't have any certainty as to what's going to happen. So did that sort of change how you went about your day-to-day life or your outlook on things?
I think it has really changed my outlook on mm-hmm. things. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in the most difficult times of my illness and treatment, it was just like day-to-day survival. Like, can mm-hmm. I, sometimes it was even like, can I make it to the end of this day? Mm-hmm. Like, this day is so difficult to get through. Will yeah. I get there? And I would.
Yeah.
And then I've found, because, yeah, there is no certainty. Like, I am now, even though I'm not officially in a trial anymore, which is a little complicated to explain to you and to others, but mm-hmm. Maybe I should just leave it at that. I'm not officially in the trial anymore, but I'm still right. on the medication. Right. Why don't we just leave it at that? Because the story of why is a little too complicated yeah. for this radio program. But yeah. But I am still like an experimental subject in a way, mm-hmm. even though I'm not part of a trial. Like, mm-hmm. my doctor is learning new things about my type of ovarian cancer in this treatment. You know, with every month I see him, I get, wow. you know, I go to the hospital once a month to get an infusion. Mm-hmm. And we know that no one has any idea how long this will last. Like, it could last mm-hmm. for 50 years, or mm-hmm. it could, next time, you know, I could start feeling sick again or have other symptoms of the cancer, in which case we'd have to shift gears. And the good news right. is that that same old chemo that I right. put off still exists.
yeah.
And there are a few other things as well that I could try. But I do find that it's really kind of clarified my mind about mm-hmm. what's important to me and how I want to spend my time. And that actually was one thing that was really interesting. Even when I first got sick, mm-hmm. you know, I was like, I was basically at home in my house for about 6 months mm-hmm. with only trips to the hospital.
Yeah.
And then having visitors come, mm-hmm. which was great, and, you know, family and so forth. But I remember thinking like, oh, when something like this happens to people, like, this is where they're supposed to realize, like, oh my gosh, I'm supposed to be living in California and, you know, working in a circus or something, you know? Yeah. and I had a lot of time by myself to reflect on, right. well, what have I been doing and why did I do it and why did I make this life choice and not that life choice? Like, yeah. I mean, because I wasn't the only, thanks to all of the support of our friends and community, like, I didn't really have to do much. Like, people were helping to clean our house. Mm-hmm. They were bringing us meals. Like, I just had to live. And so, mm-hmm. I realized I really love teaching. You know, I just wanted to come back and do my job. You yeah. know, it sounds kind of, I don't know, I thought, I don't know, it was interesting to me to do all that yeah. self-reflection and then come back to, like, this is so important to me and that other parts of my life were also important to me. You know, I didn't divorce right. my husband. Right. I didn't move to California, yeah. you know?
Yeah. Well,
so
it definitely, it's a good thing, right, that you had chosen, you were happy with everything in your life, and that was where you wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, because I feel like a lot of times what you think of, like you said, is people traveling Europe and quitting their job. And so I feel like it's really great that you were already doing everything that you loved and that was important to you.
Yeah, I felt really glad to come to that realization.
Yeah.
And I will say that on a daily basis, because I have a lot of fatigue that my doctor believes is caused by the medication itself, although maybe there's some residual from the chemo I had, because sometimes chemo can have long-term effects. But because of that, I need to rest. I mean, by rest, I mean I'm completely asleep for about 1 to 3 hours every afternoon. And so that I really have to kind of decide, well, certain things I'm not going to have time to do. And so I think on a daily basis, there are certain things that sometimes I'm just like, that's not so important to me. So I'm not even going to worry about that, you know? So
definitely.
Yeah, I have to kind of pick and choose a little bit.
Yeah. One other question. When, since you've probably learned a lot more about ovarian cancer since being diagnosed, do you ever integrate that into the biology curriculum? Because I know cancer, of course, is a module or a topic that we went over in the biology course. Have you thought about like adding anything about ovarian cancer?
That's a great question. And it kind of brings me back to a question you asked earlier that then I turned another direction. But when you said, how did it feel to come back and teach after getting sick? And it was very difficult returning in the fall of 2016 because I was still on some really tough chemo that took like a whole day to receive. So I'd have to take off work every couple of weeks or 3 weeks. And then I was very tired from it, but and so I could only come back to teaching half-time, which is what I've continued to do ever since. I've been on half-time sick leave since my diagnosis. But it was such a joy to again be working with my students. But as we approached the unit you're thinking of, looking at cell division and cancer, I started to think, well, it'd be ridiculous for me to teach about cancer without talking about my cancer. You know, like that would be just insane, because I told them that I told them I'd had cancer because I wanted to explain my regular absences. Some of them had older siblings who had been in my class or just would have had friends who knew I had cancer. And so I ended up talking with one of the school social workers to get some advice from her, just, you know, how could I share my story? And she viewed it as such a positive. She said, what a great opportunity for students to be able to learn from somebody who is actually dealing with this disease that they're also learning about in kind of an intro bio class sort of way. And I've ended up sharing more of my personal experience in terms of ovarian cancer, but I think some of what I've learned just about cancer treatment generally has informed how I teach my students about how cancer is dealt with. Well, the cause too, because, you know, there's so much better understanding of cancer in terms of like specific gene mutations that cause certain cancers and that type of thing, but then also how cancer treatment is changing.
Yeah, because I think for me as a student, at least, one of the biggest things that sort of imprints material into my mind is when it relates to real life, especially in high school, when I feel like you just sort of think of school as something that you learn about, but it's harder to see it connecting to things. When, like, in your biology class, I remember when I took it, you would connect, for example, we talked about HIV and AIDS, and that was connected to sort of the bigger picture and social justice and how it connects to the real world. And I remember that sort of stays with me a lot. And so I imagine it must be great for your students to hear about cancer, which is such a sort of big topic, when it relates, they can see it relating to the outside world when it's actually their teacher who's teaching them about it, who has experience with it. So I think that I'd imagine that must add a lot to the class and how students remember it. Yeah, and I remember actually when I heard about your diagnosis, that was one of the things that really inspired me to study biology and eventually pursue the medical field. Because I'd known I loved science, but there wasn't like a big push for me to any one direction. And then I think having something that relates the classroom to the real world really inspired me. Because as a high schooler, that hadn't really happened before, where I'd connected things in the classroom to what's going on in day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was really inspiring for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, because I've been wondering this ever since I heard that you were going to work for Steve Skates, mm-hmm. who's working on the ovarian cancer early detection test over at MGH. How did you connect with him?
Yeah. So I remember a few years ago, one of my classmates, who was in your class too, shared something on Facebook, and it was the video of you and Dr. Skates that's on the MGH website that sort of explains ovarian cancer early detection research. And I looked at it and I was like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. Like, wow. So that was sort of in the back of my mind. And then after graduating, I was thinking about what I wanted to do. And I know I wanted to do research, but I didn't really want to work. I mean, ideally, I'd want to work on something that I'm passionate about. Mm-hmm. So I decided to reach out to Dr. Skates on LinkedIn. I got like the 1 month free premium trial so that I could message him, even though we weren't like friends on it. And he replied within like the hour and was like, wow, like, you know, Dr. Murphy, I would be happy to help out anyone who knows her. Like, when can you get on a Zoom call?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So that was really awesome. So I told him like how I'd seen that video and how I wanted to be involved in any way possible. At first I was like potentially going to volunteer. And then he was like, well, actually, like, I could use some help. Like, would you be interested in working here? And I was like, yes, definitely. So he started figuring out how to sort of get that, because it wasn't like an open position. He just was like, yeah, I could use the help. And that's a really cool connection. And now that they have the funds from your fundraising, they can finally like mobilize and proceed with some of the research. So he originally got a part-time position for me, and then that transitioned, which I'm currently doing, then it's going to transition to full-time, mm-hmm. In October, which is great. So yeah, he's a huge fan.
Well, I have to say, you are incredibly resourceful. I mean, just that you, I don't know, I mean, you were like, I got my free premium LinkedIn account for 1 month so I can message him. You know, I mean, just how great is that? Just, you know, figuring out ways to contact. Right. And I just think that's fantastic. And it just is a model for other students that sometimes something might not exist, but if you're truly passionate about it, mm-hmm. Something might be able to be created. And especially okay. since you were flexible in terms of I could volunteer. And then when he says, well, maybe let's figure something out, and then starting with part-time and going to full-time, I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, thanks. And it's interesting too, because, you know, obviously graduating during the pandemic, the job market wasn't exactly booming. And I was applying to so many things online. And I think I must have applied to like 50 just random jobs online for research. And I never really heard back from any of them, or the ones I did, I heard back no.
Uh-huh.
And then it's almost like it was meant to be, because I would so much rather be doing this research that I am so passionate about and I have sort of a connection to, versus all of the other jobs that definitely seemed interesting, but I didn't sort of have this interesting story to relate to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's sort of just in general, too, like you just have to apply to so many places. I don't know if it was partly because of the pandemic and the economy in general, but it was definitely a lesson that you have to be rejected a lot of times to eventually find success. So that was definitely a lesson that I learned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it was definitely discouraging at first to not hear back or hear no's. But it ended up like working out better than I could have imagined. So I feel like it's also sort of a lesson to just trust that something will happen that's meant to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then also to be proactive, and you never know who's going to reply to you. You never know who's going to have something that works. Who's like, you never know. So it's right. always good to put yourself out there, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Wow. And I do want to mention, because we've been talking about early detection, mm-hmm. and this will be broadcast as part of our Kicks for Cancer event this year,
mm-hmm.
That it's great that there are two major cancer-fighting institutions yes. in our city that are both researching early detection for ovarian cancer.
Yes.
And so there are some researchers at Dana-Farber working on it, and then also over at MGH, Dr. Skates is also pursuing early detection. And they're using slightly, well, not... They're using different methods to try mm-hmm. to approach the scientific problem. So mm-hmm. I think that it's pretty exciting to have so many great minds right here in the area who are focusing on this. It makes me hopeful that...
Definitely. Yeah, and that's something I was wondering about, because I, of course, know all about what Dr. Skates is doing, but do you know anything about the Dana-Farber's approach, or is it sort of under wraps?
What I am familiar with is that I think they're actually looking at some sort of circulating microRNA that's in the bloodstream.
Oh, wow.
Versus looking for cancer proteins, which right. is Dr. Skates' approach, is looking for elevated levels of blood proteins.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So kind of approaching it from different molecules, which might end up being complementary in mm-hmm. the future.
Yeah, definitely. And I think these two different approaches could very well end up each complementing the other, like you said,
mm-hmm.
And turning it, combining even.
Yes.
But one interesting thing that Dr. Skates is doing that I do just want to mention, just to sort of raise awareness for the early detection, is he is using women as their own baseline. So instead of saying, okay, at this number, this is going to be the cutoff for being high risk for anyone. He looks at women at their baseline, what the levels of various proteins are normally in the blood, and then looking to see if those numbers change in women who later go on to develop ovarian cancer, because everyone's body is different. So it's just been more useful to compare women to themselves versus having like one standard. Because I think in the past, that's what some of the research for an early detection test has been. And it hasn't been hugely predictive, just because it just so depends on the person.
Mm-hmm.
So I did find that interesting as something that he discovered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is a really interesting part of his research.
Yeah.
And it speaks to how individualized our bodies are, even though we are very similar. And sometimes there could be something in our blood that everyone does have at the same level, but mm-hmm. it happens that with the particular proteins that are associated with having this cancer, that's not the case.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think with other conditions and other illnesses, it does work to just say above this number is abnormal, because it's the same in everyone. But I guess we're learning that sort of for this for ovarian cancer in particular, it might not be the same in everyone. So sort of finding those new approaches to looking at things has helped.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I do have one other question.
Okay.
Which is, what advice do you have for people who are going through a similar experience, such as receiving an unexpected diagnosis, or who have like a loved one going through it?
That's a great question. And I think there are really two different answers.
Mm-hmm.
I first think of my husband, and that I think that it's actually could be harder for the person who has a loved one who's going through a difficult disease like cancer or a difficult period. Mm-hmm. Because with something like cancer, really you're dependent on the expertise of doctors to care mm-hmm. for the patient. And sometimes the side effects of the treatment are such that, you know, things that my husband would do normally, like make me a good meal or... Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know, just give me a hug or whatever. Like when I was in chemo, I those were not comforting things necessarily. Right. You know, my right. skin might be sensitive or my body, and I couldn't eat certain things at different times. And, you know, so it was, I think it's very hard for the loved one because you want to care and you kind of, you can't always. Sometimes it's right. just, you have to just listen to what, listen to the person who has the illness or is suffering and just let mm-hmm. them explain to you. I mean, I would say, mm-hmm. you know, besides my husband, other family members too.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for the patient, and actually this would apply to the loved one too, I suppose, because mm-hmm. one thing is that until COVID happened, my husband would always come with me to the hospital, mm-hmm. which was fantastic. And I realize that's not always possible for everyone. He was just fortunate and being able to have some flexibility with his work. And but I just think having him there was so supportive. And mm-hmm. also you have the benefit of kind of two sets of ears when you're getting information, because yeah. sometimes it's hard to take it all in, especially if you're feeling really emotional.
Yeah.
So I think that's really valuable. And if you know, having a friend come with you, just another person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also, you know, there was a critical point in my treatment where, you know, I had to make a decision about choosing one thing over another, and I ended up deciding to go get a second opinion at Dana-Farber.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so helpful. It just happened that a different doctor looking at all my data with different eyes
mm-hmm.
made what turned out to be the exact right recommendation.
Wow. Yeah.
Which then I brought back to my MGH doctor and said, well, I met with so-and-so and this is what he said. And my doctor was like, let's do that then. You know, like when yeah. he heard what he'd said, it was like, yeah, that makes total sense. We should do that. And so I right. just think, with something as complicated as cancer, like we imagine that doctors know everything. Mm-hmm. There tends to be that desire to just respect everything they say. But mm-hmm. I think it's really good to ask questions. And ultimately, you know, it is the patient's decision about how the treatment progresses.
Yeah, that's so true. I feel like the way I used to think of it was just, you have this, so they're going to give you this. Like, it's an algorithm almost. But mm-hmm. it's true, especially with cancer, which is so complicated. Collaboration is so important because nobody knows everything.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the best answer comes from combining ideas.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I think the patient needs to be part of that decision making.
Definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because they ultimately are going to know what works for them and what doesn't too.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I guess I would also just put in a plug for palliative care, which is a department in most, maybe all hospitals, I'm not sure. And I initially thought that palliative care primarily worked with people who were on hospice close to dying.
Mm-hmm.
But I connected with palliative care maybe 6 months into my disease. Mm-hmm. And I learned, I mean, I was in a tough situation. And so,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think they kind of thought things could go either way during 2016, to be perfectly mm-hmm. honest. And fortunately, they went a positive direction. Mm-hmm. But I also learned that because more and more people are living with really difficult diseases with complex treatments for very long periods of time, the palliative care has shifted their focus to more symptom management. Mm-hmm. Because when you're taking a lot of medications for cancer or certain other diseases, they can have their own side effects and problems to manage. And yeah. palliative care sometimes has expertise that your oncologist or other specialist doctor might not have. So I think a lot of people aren't aware that that's part of what they do. But
I wasn't aware.
They were so helpful to me and continue to be.
Yeah. And I feel like there's something to be said, too, for being comfortable during your treatment, because part of recovery probably depends on feeling supported and feeling comfortable and feeling hopeful.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the more comfortable you can be, as you say, like just the happier you feel. And mm-hmm. we don't really understand how our emotions relate to the immune system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but certainly it can't hurt to feel loved and comfortable. And, as you say, that's going to promote hope and perhaps help the body do what it can.
Right, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much for being so open about everything and answering all my questions. I think this was very informative for me, and I'm sure for everyone listening. So thank you. And did you have any other questions?
Well, I just want to say thank you for... I don't know, for being my student, for caring so much, uh-huh. for remembering that video and deciding to contact Dr. Skates. Yeah. And and when I saw his text, you know, a couple, I don't remember exactly when it was, 6 or 8 weeks ago, and like, Natalie Waldron, oh my gosh, they've connected. Like, it was amazing to me. And like two different pieces of my world coming together, and just... I don't know. It's meant so much to me as a teacher. Really makes me feel like...
I'm glad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's all inspired by you. So thank you, too, for being such a role model for your students. And I'm sure not just me. So thank you. That's had a huge impact on my life.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Thanks, Natalie. Yeah. You're impacting my life right now.
Good. I'm glad.
Great.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye, Dr. Murphy.
Bye, Natalie.
WIQH is broadcasting the show you heard just now frequently this month, leading up to the somewhat delayed Kicks for Cancer soccer games to be played live on Saturday, October 4th. So even though this is a very different year for KFC, the Concord-Carlisle soccer and field hockey teams still do get the opportunity to play traditional Kicks opponents Lincoln-Sudbury. Check WIQH.org for this show's rebroadcast times, along with more information about our Kicks for Cancer-related sports broadcasts. Thanks to Steve Wells, Ray Pavlik, Nora Murphy, Natalie Waldron, Madeline Pooler, and everyone on the Kicks for Cancer Organizing Committee who made this show possible. And thanks for listening.